My name's Al McGeehee, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to comment about this chain that these people are sitting back here. It looks like a jail. It reminded me of Southern California Convention years ago. They had in Anaheim. I think there was about 7,000 or 8,000 registrations, and they had the banquet in one portion, and they sold separate tickets. You know, if you went to the banquet, you got to go to the show, right? And if you didn't want to eat that food, then you could just buy a ticket for the show. And I was an usher. And that's how many years that I since learned then not to be ushers at Anaheim at all. Because they said it was halfway through the banquet speaker, and they're going like this to all the ushers, get out, get out, get out. And I swear, I'm going, I haven't eaten yet, I haven't listened, you know, get out. We went out and we had to hold back this horde of serene alcoholics trying to get into the arena to get their seat. And I'm paranoid as hell. I don't know about you, but I don't like to be backed up against doors by 500 or 600 people in a small hallway, you know. I've spent most of my life in hallways, but I didn't like that one. So anyway, they said, well, now go inside, and this section's reserved for all of the ushers. And they put me in charge to keep the alcoholics out of there, you know, that weren't ushers. And I managed to save 2 seats out of that. I mean, I never saw such an unruly set of bastards in my entire life as a group of alcoholics that paid their money to see an AA show, you know. And this reminds me of that. You know, of course, I don't know what that's for, that change and thing. But I can remember the first spring roundup that we had in San Diego, I participated in, and we had the whole committee in the front row. And the reason we had the whole committee was because if the speaker bombed out, we were all going to leave and just leave you have your own goddamn convention, you know. It's nice to be here. I want to thank the committee and San Diego Spring Roundup to for inviting me down. My wife and I moved away from our home group in Carlsbad many years ago, and we live up in Central California, which is really the hotbed of AA, if you want to know. And it's nice to be here. In fact, it's nice to be anywhere nowadays. It's nice to be safe and somewhat sane and sober these days, and I always couldn't say that. I'd like to ask right now, is there anybody here for their first San Diego Spring Roundup? Look at that. Raise your hand, Sherry. Sherry, raise your hand. Yeah, but not as one of us. Isn't that something? I have 2 daughters here, both on the program, and I have my Al-Anon wife. Yeah, you know, somebody asked me, said one time, you know, you really ought to go to Al-Anon. And I said, what, give up all that control? You know, that's what they do in Al-Anon. They practice release. We say, you know, we just turn it over to God whenever we can. I guess I'm going to have to get in here and tell you, if you already don't know, a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. I attended the early bird meeting last night, and first I've got to tell you, and you know, Al-Anon's practice release. Notice the word practice. We got here very early yesterday, and the first thing my Al-Anon did, well, let's go get your packet. See, Al-Anons are not completely trustworthy of us yet. She couldn't believe that they were going to have everything prepared for us. And so we come in, and there was only 2 or 3 people at the registration. They hadn't put out anything. I mean, this was like early yesterday. I don't even know what the hell the guys were doing there at that time. But anyway, So we came, no, they're not here. So-and-so has them. So we went away and said, come back in a half hour. So we came back. We went through this routine four or five times before the guy arrived that had our packet. And so I finally got, and of course they didn't have Sarah registered. She says, ha, I knew it. Ha. And we got that squared away, and then she says, well, where's the ticket? I said, hell, I don't know. Where are the tickets? The guy said, well, they're over at the table. So I walked over and got the tickets, and I started to put them away in my Al-Anon, being trustworthy as Al-Anons are, but not quite as trustworthy as us. Said, open it up, see if they're all there. I love Al-Anons. God bless them, you know. Are there any Al-Anons here, by the way? Great. I'm telling you, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for Al-Anon, that's for sure. I felt different most of my life. I don't know about you. I felt like that I didn't belong. I even fantasized when I was a kid that I was dropped on my daddy's doorstep, you know, and really wasn't one of them, because at times I felt superior too, but most of the time inferior to my family. And I had that brought home many times during my early childhood. And I was, it seems like that I was born to be left-handed. And at that time in California, when I started to school, grade school, at that time, left-handed people were really considered MR. And I don't know if that's true or not, but they decided they were going to change all of us left-handed kids into right-handed people because it was truly a right-handed world. And, of course, I stood out. And even from an early age, there's one thing that I didn't want to do was draw the wrong kind of attention to myself. And when I started school, I got all of this wrong kind of attention. And I can remember one day when I had a very bad case of dysentery. And I went to school, and I was late. And this teacher just jerked me right through the door, you know, because I was late. And she didn't like me, and I was terrified of her. And she jerked me. She just picked me up right off my feet and hit me right across the ass like that. She dropped me rather quickly because she went, oh, my God, you know. And, Christ, I can remember that laughter even today, because there I was drawing the wrong kind of attention. And as a result of that, I think when I got transplanted down in the big city of Sacramento, down in Skid Row, that I was going to be determined to be hip, slick, and cool for the rest of my life. And, you know, I really practiced that. I practiced such a facade that you never knew what the hell was going on with me. And, of course, I don't know where I'd been today if I hadn't been an alcoholic. And I'm so blessed to be an alcoholic, because I found out all of these things in retrospect. Anyway, I can remember those early days. I can remember taking my first drink with my peers. Now, I had beer and a little wine and whiskey, you know, as a family thing goes, because all of my family were drinkers. But I can remember that first drink on my own. And, a couple of us that played in the dance band in junior high school, we went out and we had a wino go out and buy us a couple of ponies of Santa Fe Toque. Oh, man, I can sure taste that today. Terrible stuff, but man, did it work. It worked good, you know. I don't know if you guys can remember that. I mean, that kind of warm feeling going down your first real belt, hits the stomach, and you follow it with another one. All of a sudden, you go, you know, relax, you know, and all your pimples fall off, and you grow 3 or 4 inches everywhere, you know, and you just feel fantastic. God damn, I love that. I don't know about you, but I really like that feeling. And I pursued it. That particular day, I didn't pursue it for too long because I passed out and puked and it was over, but I sure remembered what it was for a few minutes. God, it was great. It just took everything off, and it changed my perspective of everything. And I knew I'd found something. I knew I had found whatever it was that I was looking for that was going to make it all right for me to be in the world. There's only one thing wrong with that scenario. It seems that I was allergic to the damn stuff. And, of course, you know what happens with us alcoholics. We get into a little trouble now and then. You know, Cliff Arp talks about being out with a group of Al-Anons and watching them ordering drinks. And, you know, that's a goddamn circus. That really is. If you ever watch any normal person drink, you wonder, what the hell they doing it for? You know, they, first of all, they gotta find out every kind of liquor that's available before they can make up their mind what to drink. I never had that problem. Then they'll leave a glass half full until after dinner. Or they'll just get up and leave it. I never knowingly left a glass half full of anything, let alone booze. And I still don't today. But anyway, what I'm saying is I never knew that there was such a thing as normal drinking. I thought I drank normally. I thought to drink was to have fun, to feel good. Otherwise, why bother with it? I got into a lot of trouble from time to time drinking, as most of us do. I joined the Marine Corps and came down south. By the way, I'm a native Californian, and I don't care to live any other place except in California. And my company has other ideas, and I'm telling them, no, you don't understand. You don't transplant people like me. You know, we don't fare well any other way. You know, I forgot what the hell I was going to say right then, but I wanted to get that out because Mert's here from Florida, and she says she loves it. She lives in Orlando now, and my company's been trying to waive an application for me to move down to Orlando, and I've been to Florida, and that's it. I've just been to Florida, and anyway, I joined the Marine Corps, and I came down to San Diego, and then in and around Carlsbad, and that's where I met my wife Sarah, and we got married, and we've been happy from time to time ever since. I tell you, anybody that, you know, I pity normal people who get married. What the hell do they do? You know, I mean, they can't stay in bed forever, for Christ's sake. Mine was kind of an adventure whether I was ever going to get into bed from time to time, you know. But our life, basically has all the elements of the disease of alcoholism. I mean, I infected everybody with my disease. And it's needless to say that I was a Jekyll and Hyde character because when I drank, my personality changed. And the poor wife and kids never knew what I was exactly going to change into. I might be happy one drunk, and I might be destructive and outrageously violent another time. You know, I used to think that I was, when I first came around, that I was a relatively calm drunk. And I forgot about all those times where I took my hands and punched out vestibules in apartments where we lived, you know, broke out all the windows and busted the doors. That's not very passive behavior. And that used to bother me a little bit from time to time. But alcoholics of my nature, well, we seem to be very resilient in varying things like that. Because I don't know why. I suppose in retrospect, it's because we don't want to take a look at ourselves. Anyway, our married life started and it went on its merry, merry way. And God, that was terrible sometimes, and sometimes it was wonderful. You know, this disease of ours, at least what it did to me and for me, it kept me out there for so many years. You know, I can identify a little bit with people coming in after, you know, 5 or 6 years of heavy drinking and using. But mine wasn't the case. I drank for many years because sometimes I would drink with impunity. And that's really all I've ever been looking for. I can remember our first episode that I got into a real jam. One night they arrested me for a felonious hit-and-run drunk driving and 3 counts of assault. And that was interesting. And what I got out of that is I got myself a smart attorney. That's what I got out of it. And he pled alcoholism. Now, this was back in 1958. It was unusual. And I don't know how he did it, but he did it. I paid a small fine, and the judge told me, he said, young man, you ought to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Find out if you have a problem. And I did. I went to one meeting in Sacramento, California. That's where I busted. I was living at the time. And I like to remember that meeting because some of you may be feeling that way. I know there's quite a few relatively new people, I guess, in the room. I went to that meeting, and everybody in that meeting was 105 years old, for Christ's sake. And all them old fools were wearing trench coats, you know, and they're drinking this black stuff called coffee. You know, and they're sitting around the table discussing how one drink is too much for them. And I thought, hell yeah, it's too much for you. One out between you, kill all of them, for Christ's sake. They mentioned something else, though, at that meeting that years later I was to remember. They said that alcoholism was a disease, and it was a physical allergy coupled with an obsession of the mind. I don't know why I remembered that, but I did. Many years later, in one of my geographics, I found myself living once more down in Oceanside, across that area, and I had a couple of partners. We were running a little insurance office or front, whatever you want to call it, and on Hill Street in downtown Oceanside. We used to hawk Marines. That's what we used to do, you know, sell them that GI insurance, you know, and we did that until we got kicked off the base. But anyway, this one particular day, my partner and I, which happened to be Sarah's niece's husband, we started drinking rather early. The Normandy was right next to our office. So, you know, he was our landlord. And anyway, we went over there and we started drinking, and he started blowing up and turning red and getting blotchy. I said, my God, man, what the hell's the matter with you? He said, I don't know, but I don't feel too well. And he says, come think of it, you don't look too good either. I said, you know, it's a little hot in here. And pretty soon we started throwing up all over the place. Well, we came to the right conclusion. Clyde Truss, the owner of that bar, was serving us green beer, that's for sure. So we moved to another bar. What else could you do? And same thing there. We said, hell, the whole town must have a batch of bad beer. Let's go over down to Carlsbad. Same truck had been there and dropped off all the bad beer. But we wound up over in Vista. 2 o'clock in the morning in front of the El Sombrero, sitting on the curb, wondering what the hell, everybody in the whole North County's got bad food, right? So we're sitting there contemplating our fate between throwing up. And I said, oh, wait a minute, Danny. I know what the hell's the matter. And he says, yeah, what's that? I said, we caught that damn disease, alcoholism. He says, what do you mean? How did we get that? I don't know, off the toilet seat or water glass or some damn place, but I know we got it. And I told him this story about me going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called AA. And I stayed sober for 2 years till I found out I didn't have it. But something, I am a firm believer, and I say this up in my home group in Santa Maria Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, that whatever reason gets us to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, if you're an alcoholic, you walk through the door and sit through one meeting, it's never the same again. Something happens. Whether you stay with us or not, something happens to you, because I know it did to me. Well, of course, the drinking didn't stop after I went out, but I can tell you this. After having spent 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous in Oceanside, we had an Alamo Club. And I was a charter member of that Alamo Club. It was up behind the liquor store next door to Pernicano's up there on Hill Street. And the cockroaches used to outnumber the members, you know. You know, that's kind of a funny thing when I think about it. You know, nobody would admit that there were damn cockroaches in that place. That's how much sobriety we had. We all thought each other were, you know. Until we had a little gal come in, Shirley B., and she asked me, she says, you know how she was, those of you who knew her, she says, are those really cockroaches up there, or am I hallucinating? Yeah. And I said, no, they're real. You know, what else could I see? I saw them. We had a lot of fun there, but when I went back out to drink again, it was not the same. It was desperation this time. And it was drinking without that, you know, we sober up in our early stages of alcoholism, and we have a little problems, and we feel remorseful. But in a few days or a week or two of being good, those feelings are gone. And we're once more in control. This time, this wasn't the case. I always felt that hole in the pit of my stomach, that uncertainty, that impending doom and disaster, whether I was drinking or not. And a funny thing, too, for a while I drank with impunity after I went back out. By that I mean I had successful drinking bouts. I didn't get into any trouble. I didn't necessarily get falling down drunk. But I always felt bad when I drank, after I drank. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous several times. There's lots of humor in that. It was at this particular time that my Al-Anon was practicing her art. She was in training for a sixth degree black belt at that time. Now, you have to understand that, though you know Sarah, she's of Mexican heritage, and she clings to some of the old world, quote-unquote, ideas. Couple that with being Catholic, and you've got a full-blown mystic on your hands. And she used to cart me around down to Tijuana and up to Downey and different places to see the Mexican spiritualists. And that was a trip. You know, they say that alcoholics don't have any backbone or willpower. Well, I disagree with that. I mean, none of them dummies ever had to sit in a car and drive all the way up to Downey during a Santa Ana, you know, without a drink and a hangover, for Christ's sakes, to see some Mexican spiritualist. You walk into them places, you know, and they're burning incense. The only time I ever burned incense, I was smoking pot. I don't know about you. And, of course, I'd agreed to anything, you know. And we used to go to a place called Harmony Grove. And that's a place where they have evangelists and seers and people that can heal. And I don't know, it may have worked. Look where I'm at today. But I had a lot of healing. I got hit in the forehead quite a bit, you know. And, of course, Sarah, being Catholic, she didn't pass up the opportunity to use all of the tools of the Catholic faith to try to heal her alcoholic. And she used to collect palms on Palm Sunday. And she would keep the palms underneath the bed. And she would bless me with them when I came in a little under the weather. Now, that's all right during April, but in December, them damn palms get a little hard, you know. I used to have wealth all over me. And she kept a lot of holy water and candles burning. And she used to bless me with holy water. I got a chronic sinus condition. I know that's what it's from. Boy, she did her best. And I'm not so sure it all didn't pay off. But, you know, our place was a zoo with that kind of behavior. You got to understand that nowadays I understand that's really not normal behavior. I mean, Sarah has come a long way. Now she only burns candles. Although somebody gave her a palm the other day, last weekend, and I looked out of the corner of my eye and I said, you really going to keep that? So every night I look underneath the bed to see if that palm is there. But we went on our way, and of course it just tore the family apart. It is a family disease, make no mistake about that. And it kills us alcoholics, and it kills our families. and it does it in the most insidious way. It would be different if we died spectacularly. You know, like one time on one of my ins and outs of AA, I shot up the town of Carlsbad. Makes a great story. Actually, here's what happened. I went down, I was drinking in the casino. Now, that's a pretty high-class place, you know. It's about on the, well, it's not quite as bad as Ralph and Eddie's. I don't know, it's on a par, I guess. Anyway, they kicked me out. Me, one of their best patrons. They kicked me out. And I went home and got my gun. And when I got back, they were closed. So I went around back and I shot the joint up from the back. You know, just put holes everywhere. And I was real cool about it because after I did that, I tucked the gun in my waistband and walked around front and got in my car and went home, you know. And nobody ever said anything about that. You know, God, I felt bad the next day. Hallelujah. I didn't, you know. I kept looking at all the cops in town, wondering if they were going to stop me. And I felt so bad so many times. And I used to go to that church and take vows. Now, if you're Catholic, you know what that means. This is very serious business. I mean, if you take a vow and break it, you're in deep trouble. And this last vow I took, I'm telling you, it was beautiful. I wished I had the words that we both said, the Father and I. After talking, and I went to confession, and I said the rosary umpteen times, you know, and all of that. And, man, I hit the steps of that church, and I felt like my troubles were over. I was healed of whatever it was that was making me behave the way that I had behaved. And I had taken a vow never to drink again. Forever. I got a half a block from that church and I decided, now I didn't mean not to drink, I meant not to get drunk forever. And there is a difference. I lasted a block and a half is what I did on that vow that particular time, and I got drunk. And now that's devastating. It really is, because I was serious. I was sincere with that vow. That was demoralizing. That was, you've all been there, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Just think about that for me. It was incomprehensible how demoralized I was. I had nothing. I used to commit suicide from time to time. You know how we are when we get depressed with a hangover, you know, we're not prone to rational acts. And my attempts were rather unique. I used to try to choke myself to death. Have you ever tried that? That's the damnedest feeling. I mean, just as you're starting to pass out, your hands are relaxed, you know, both, they're awake again. I stuck my head in an oven once, and that's nauseous. You know, I want to die, I don't want to throw up. I got a 150-foot garden hose one time and went out, and I had this hard top, this Buick Riviera, and I've been out, I've listened to that sweet jazz and everything, and piped that gas into the car with all the windows open, you understand, you know. That did the effect. And finally, there's a little Banny Rooster up in North County. Most of you know him, Bill B. You know, I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous that time that I sobered up for 2 years with him and Margie, his wife. And I didn't want to be like Bill Blake. No way. I mean, the guy, he was sober a year and he lost all his hair, for Christ's sake. Man, that ain't nice thing I want, you know. And little did I realize that he was going through what we now call a growth period. But when it came time to come back, when there was no other place to turn to, who did I turn to? I turned to Bill. And he was the only guy that would spend some time with me. I used to sell cars on the strip there. And him and Margie, I don't know why, they didn't drive the kind of cars that I sold. I sold General Motors products. They still drive Fords today, I guess, Ford products. And they used to drop by out every once in a while. And you know how Bill is. Margie is sweet, but Bill said, "How you doing now?" and smiled, you know. And I said, "Well, I'm doing all right. How are you?" You know. And God, it was terrible talking to that man. I didn't want to see him, but yet every time he came by, I didn't want him to leave for some reason. And when it came time to call somebody, that's who I called. And that started that merry-go-round. And the last time I got drunk, I had been sober for 90 days, and I collected one more of them tokens, you know. You know, I was a brass collector by this time. God, I had so many of them tokens. And I got drunk. And when I got drunk this last time, I just knew that I was one of those that we talk about in chapter 5. You know, I just couldn't be honest with myself. I just couldn't do it. I was unable to. And that last drunk lasted about 8 hours. And I came back one more time. And the miracle worked. Just like that. The miracle worked. Now I know why it worked. I don't know how it worked. But I know why it worked. It's because a hand of Alcoholics Anonymous was out one more time for Al. And I never want to forget that, because if it hadn't been, where would I be today? In jail? Insane? Dead? Possibility. Or maybe it will be like it was before. Just one rotten, hopeless day after another. Day in and day out. That's probably the most terrible part about my disease, is that hopelessness I used to feel every day. The miracle worked this last time, and I got active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did something I hadn't done the previous 2 years. I took step one for the first time, and I took step two, and I took step three, and I took these with my sponsor because I wasn't trusting my judgment anymore. You know, and the miracle was working when I got active, and God, it was tremendous. I can remember one time there was a group of us that were, we went down to Southgate Pioneers, and on the way back, we stopped at a coffee shop, and we were having, you know, pie and ice cream and all that things we, you know, we do before our health goes bad. and Cliff and Skip are talking about interviews. Now, you know, you all know what that is, especially with today's treatment program and everything. And I can't get a word in edgewise. And it's beginning to bug me. And they're talking about how they took it and how they didn't take it and how they used to time their, you know, and all that stuff. Finally, I couldn't stand it any longer, and I butted right in, and I said, "I don't know anything about that crap. Every time I come off a drunk, I kick it cold turkey." My sweet Al-Anon, who was eating her pie and ice cream and everything, she says, "I think I have something to tell you." And I says, "Yeah, what's that?" "You remember that time that you and Denny caught the disease alcoholism?" And I says, "Yes." She says, "Well, my niece and I were putting antabuse on your tortillas and eggs, you know." Now I know why she used to make them runs down to Tijuana, because that's where she bought it, you know. Damn specialist turned her on to that, you know. Going to drive the demons out of this guy, you know. Hey, that stuff works good. Makes you sicker than hell, man. If you're on it, don't drink today, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous has completely changed my life. I would like to say it completely changed Al, but, you know, you're alcoholics and you know that's not true. But it has changed most of my actions, which has slowly changed how Al feels about Al inside. And how I feel about life. How I look at the spiritual entity of my own life and those that I share my life with. Easy. And it hasn't been hard. What it has been, it has been. And I never knew that because I thought I took a lot of lumps in my sobriety. When I took my fifth with my sponsor, he told me that I had a huge resentment against my mother, and I told him he was wrong. I didn't even know the lady. She left when we were young. And she happened to be living at that time with her husband, my stepdad, in Oceanside. And he says, oh yeah, you've got to do something about that. So we moved quickly, rather quickly, into the rest of the steps so I could get to that point where I could start making amends. And he says, now you must do this. You must make amends to your mother this way. You will see your mother, make it a point to visit her once a week. And every time you see her, you must kiss her and tell her that you love her. I looked at him, I said, you want me to do that? And he said, do it or get another sponsor. Now, for a moment, you know, I thought about that. I thought about trading Bill in because, you know, I am not built that way to do that sort of thing. But I didn't, and I tried the best I could to do that over the next few years. And we used to play volleyball over in the park on Carlsbad on the weekend. And so I picked that out as a time to stop and visit my mother on the way over to the park. We used to ride the bicycle most of the time over to the park. And I would stop and we would chit-chat and I'd have coffee and boom, I'm out the door, you know, and I'd peck her on the cheek, say, bye, Mom, I love you, and out the door. Right? Well, I was doing the physical thing. It didn't have much heart in it, but I was doing it. This one day, a very special day in my life, I stopped. She had the coffee ready. I was on the bike. It was early in the morning. I sat down. The coffee got cold. I looked up, and it was 12:30. What had happened was we had finally shared with each other the things that a son and a mother share with each other, I was later to realize. And it was so beautiful. I can't describe to you how I felt, especially when I said, gee, Mom, I really wanted to stay, and I felt so good. I said, I got to go over. We're having a game today. And as I got up to leave, she stood up, and I picked her right up off her feet. She was a rather small woman, a little frail, a little sickly. And I said, Mom, I love you, and I kissed her. And she said these words. She says, oh, God, I've waited so long to hear those words. God, I felt 10 feet tall. I felt so good you can't imagine. You can't imagine the feeling that I had. The next day, we found her dead. And my first reaction was one of anger and hostility towards this God who had given me such a tremendous gift to snatch it away like that. I didn't deserve that. Why give it to me if you're going to take it away? What I was to find out through talking to people, especially to my sponsor, my God, where do people like us get the wisdom when we act as sponsors in situations like this? I don't know. But he says, let me tell you something. So the Alcoholics Anonymous has given you one of the rarest gifts it has to give. You got a chance to make an amendment to a parent, to your mother, and to receive the love and affection from your mother and give it back willingly. Because most of us don't get that chance. We get here, they're already gone. Most of us get here, we don't stay here. We die drunk. We never get that chance. God has been very generous in my life. He gave me that beautiful gift. Of course, God also gave me my ego and my self-centeredness. And that has caused me no end of pain in sobriety. And it has caused me no end of joy in sobriety because my sponsor told me a long time ago, he says, dummy, you're so sick, we're just going to take your ego and make it a positive thing. That's all I've ever been able to do with it. Because one of the symptoms of my disease is, of course, I'm self-centered. You wouldn't have guessed that, you know, but I am very self-centered. And I love these bashes. I really do. You know, you take an alcoholic like me and you say, hey, would you like to come over and share with us at the group? For Christ's sakes, you're playing right to my disease. That's right. I can get to talk about myself for a whole hour or so, you know. I can't do that at home. I've tried that. I told my wife one time, you know, when I was first sober, you know, I told her, she was carrying on about this and that and so on, and whatever it was, I don't even remember what it was. Now I said, you're going to make me nervous and I'm going out and get drunk. She just said, oh, shit, and went on her way, you know. But we've had a lot of problems. I've had a lot of problems in sobriety, and one of them's been with my Al-Anon and our relationship. Curious thing about Sarah and I, we like to practice things. We really do. I hope I get this right. We've been separated a couple of times, divorced once, and married four times. To each other, not to anybody else, just to each other. Now, I don't know how the hell that happened, but it happened, you know, and I got to tell you that we got divorced this last time, and we wanted to set the divorce aside, right? And so she called up her attorney, and he said, no problem, but she wants to retake our vows, and that's a good idea. So we go retake our vows. And it was beautiful, you know. We had this minister that my wife had been associated with for a number of years, and it was beautiful. But it was just, you know, taking the vow. And then after I was over with, a few weeks later, this her attorney called her up and said, did you sign any papers when you took your vows? My mom says, no. My wife says, no. That's a slip. My wife says, no. She says, well, you should have because you're not married. So we had to go get married again. The same minister said, he said, is there something I'm doing wrong or, you know. And we had to go over to the county courthouse and pull out another marriage license. Now that's not bad, but I'm sensitive, and I as you tell by my story, I embarrass rather easily. And we got over there. Christ, we knew everybody in the damn joint, you know. And they're saying hi, and we're saying hi. We're not telling them what we're doing, and we're sitting at the bench, you know. And I'm trying to move Sarah over so we're in a different license area, you know, not in a marriage license area. We had to buy that damn license and go through the same thing again. But I've learned a lot from Sarah. And because when we walked away from each other, as an alcoholic, I went into a depression and didn't know why. And I had to ask myself, wait a minute, all of those things that I had been telling some of the guys that I sponsored, have I done all those things? Like making sure that I have done everything on my part for this relationship in a positive note. And when I asked that very tough question, the answer was no. So I asked my God, if I get the chance, I would like to go back and make sure that I do all of those things. That's all I asked him. And I got the chance. And I've tried very hard to do all those things. My wife's a very outgoing, loving, friendly lady. But my wife is also something else. My wife is the kind of person who thinks because I think something is important in my life, it becomes important in her life. Think about that. I don't know of any practicing drunk who thinks that way. I don't know many of us who sober up without many years of growing on this program that thinks that way. I certainly didn't. And I learned a great lesson there. I should say learned, it sounds like I've got it down pat. I've observed a great thing there. And I've tried to make that part of my life that says that anything that Sarah thinks that's important in her life becomes important in my life. And you know, and all the philosophical things you hear about relationships, well, you got to do this, 50-50, that, 20-40, you know, whatever it is, it pales beside that kind of simple philosophy. And that's the philosophy of an Al-Anon. And in that philosophy, it says, let go and let God, and release with love. I have since devised a prayer that I say almost every day of my life. And that's prayers of release with love, which I simply state for those, especially who are very close to me, that I do ask God for their success, security, health, and happiness, and I release them with love. I can't tell you how well it has served me in some of the crises that all of us go through just as a family. I can't tell you how well it served me. My life is rather full at the moment, but as you know how we are, tomorrow it could be rather empty. Some of you who are new in Alcoholics Anonymous are going to pick people out who you look up to, who you will try and put on a pedestal. If I have anything to give you today, besides what I've shared, my experience, strength, and hope, don't do that to yourself. All of us, regardless of how long we've been sober on this program, have feet of clay. I know I do. I can be drunk before the day is done. I've seen it happen time and time again. And I'm no different than the guy that I heard just a year or so ago saying, Jesus Christ, I'll never quit going to meetings. When you quit going to meetings, you get drunk. He quits going to meetings and gets drunk. And then it happens to them. There's an old guy up in our group with 34 years of sobriety. He is dying before our eyes. He has emphysema so bad. He can prolong his life if he'll stay home and stay tied up to that can. But Bill still goes to 3 and 4 meetings a week. And when you ask him, why don't you stay home? Christ, this is killing you. You know what his answer was? There's more to life than being alive. And I think that's a message for us. I think it's fitting that those 10 years ago that Bill and a small group of us got together, Stu, Harriet, Charlie T., Skip, and I think 4 or 5 other people, their names escape me right now, got together and we decided we would have a celebration of sobriety. That's kind of funny, the way we picked out the Easter date. I don't know if everybody remembers, but I remembered it. You can't have a celebration of this nature on Easter. It's sacrilegious, for Christ's sake. You can't do that. And yet, isn't it fitting that we do celebrate our spiritual rebirth? Our spiritual rising up from the dead that we were, if you're alcoholic like I am. It's so fitting that we celebrate together at this time of year. That was a lot of fun back in those days. Where I'm at now, there's many a time that I wish with all of, or yearn, I guess would be a better word, with all my heart to be back down here, sharing my life with the people who have given me so much through the years. But God takes care of people like me in Alcoholics Anonymous because He set up all the things in motion to bring me to this day and this morning where I can stand before a lot of you who I know and have known for a number of years and who I've just met today and those that I don't know, that I can be here in the area where I love and where my heart and my sobriety began and is, and to share with you on this 10th annual San Diego Spring Roundup. For that, I'm really grateful to the committee, Robin. And I'm grateful to you. Thank you so much for allowing me to share.